Well, needless to say, and I could hear it in your sort of whistles and cheers and claps, we are all really excited about tonight's extraordinary speaker. And I am particularly fortunate that I have the honor to introduce one of my personal heroes. As Terry just mentioned, we were very grateful when she was here 5 years ago in 2000 to help us launch our new graduate program, which is, I'm happy to say, flourishing at this point, and many of the students and even graduates from the program are here tonight with us. And so we're just thrilled that she's back, and we're even thinking, how can we perpetuate this? How can we make sure that Vandana Shiva visits us on a regular basis? Well, I first met her in the women's tent, that's tent number 10, at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. I was in awe. I saw in action the author of Staying Alive, Women, Ecology, and Development, as she steered events in the NGO forum and within the halls of the official Earth Summit representatives. She's a persuasive author of numerous books, but we also know her to be personally dynamic, powerful, effective, and a tireless worker. Whoop, what's happened to my... I'm okay? Okay, tireless worker on behalf of the environment. Of course, being brilliant and charismatic helps her to carry her message far and wide, but as an educator standing in the halls of higher education, I cannot fail to notice this. She prepared herself to extend her political and intellectual reach to their maximum through completing the full range of education. Dr. Shiva holds a PhD. Thus, she stands toe to toe commandingly with leaders from world governments, international organizations, and transnational corporations. Her concerns cannot be dismissed. She works on many fronts. Here are some of the images that I hold. Partnering with an elderly Indian couple to stand in defense of mangrove forests in India, which people seek to tear out for shrimp aquaculture. Serving as a drafter of the Cartagena Protocol on biosafety. Inspiring the NGO crowd of thousands at regular World Bank meetings, and interacting with Bill Moyers on his Now TV program just several months ago. The images paint a picture of a person who is comfortable participating in every facet of environmental advocacy, from local grassroots actions to the bright lights of the international stage, where she is unquestionably a star. Please join me in saluting and welcoming this woman of many phenomenal talents, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Now, where should we hook it?
Behind?
You have to hook it there.
Where I'm from.
Oh, that's good. That's all right. It doesn't show.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you, Terry. And thank you to all the programs that worked to bring me back. Terry was under the impression it was just 2 years ago, and I was sure it was longer than 2 years ago till we figured out it was 5 years ago. But time does pass in this kind of work. And what I've learned over my now 3 decades of environmental work and environmental activism is just a few lessons I'd like to share with you on education for sustainability, but through how I've learned lessons in sustainability and how we are engaging in public action as an aspect of education. Well, the first thing I've learned is, as far as lessons in sustainability are concerned, and education for sustainability is concerned, is that everyone is a student everywhere all the time, not just in classrooms. It's the one aspect where you just cannot master the art unless you're living it. And you can't master the art in a certain set of years, yeah, kind of become an undergrad in international relations, become an M.Tech in information technology. And normally, you know, once you've reached that stage, that's the end of your learning. The rest of the time, you're replicating what you learned. In sustainability, there is never an end. Every day is a new beginning. And you can't box up education for sustainability. There's no way you can lock it up into a particular disciplinary track. There's always osmosis from other disciplines. And not only is there no boxing off in disciplines, there is no boxing off between knowing and acting. There is no possible division between living sustainability and thinking sustainability. Of course, there are people who try, but the rate at which the ecological crisis is unfolding, if all you're doing is a theory, you're outmoded before you start. Because this is the next thing you have to address and the next level of connections you have to see. Some of this stubbornness to not see. I was just thinking of when you talked about the whole issue of industrial shrimp farming and the destruction of mangroves. I got involved in it because coastal communities were being devastated by shrimp farms, which literally, you know, pump the sea onto the land, as a result of which the seawater starts to seep out. It destroys the farmlands around. To build these farms, the mangroves must be destroyed. The coastal areas, which are commons, the beaches are a commons from where the traditional fishermen set sail, they can't harvest their fish, they can't dry their fish, they've got no commons left. And I remember a particular song they sang for me when I was traveling the coasts to work with them about how they said, we were the Patappu Rajas, we were the kings of the coast, and today we've been reduced to destitutes. This was in the 90s. 94, we filed a case on behalf of that old couple, beautiful Gandhians, Jagannathan, Mr. and Mrs. Jagannathan. And 96 or 97, the Supreme Court, just looking at the figures of what this industry was doing, ordered its closure. For every acre of a shrimp farm, you have a shadow of 200 acres of destruction. That's mangroves and agricultural lands that have to be destroyed. For every dollar of the shrimp economy, you know, for what's earned through trading and exporting shrimp, you have $10 of destruction in the local economy. And for every job in the shrimp industry, you have 15 livelihoods destroyed in fisheries and farming locally. So if you're just looking at the dollar of trade or the acre of the farm or the job created, it's all growing. It's all growth. But you look at the shadow side, the destruction is outweighing the economy that's being generated. And that's what led to the Supreme Court order, brilliant order, which basically said, you have given us the dollar argument, but we are not convinced because far more is being destroyed than what your dollar earnings are bringing to the country. And so we order closure. Of course, the shrimp industry involves all the big giant corporations. Their local contractors involve all the politicians and all the big bureaucrats. Of course, they subverted the order. They continue to farm. And I remember, must have been 97 or 98, I did a major public hearing for all the coastal communities affected. And one particular evidence still comes to my mind. The evidence of a person who said, you know, till the mangroves were there, the wind velocities used to be reduced by 50%. And he said, the next time we have a massive storm, we won't be protected. Sure enough, 26 December, when the tsunami came, it's the villages where the mangroves had been destroyed that you have the highest mortalities. And villages where the mangroves were not destroyed by the shrimp farms, not a single death. The tsunami had the same velocity, except it was absorbed by the mangroves. And one would imagine that in a sustainable system where there is education for sustainability, that simple correlation would, at least after that tragic disaster, register. But guess what the World Bank is using its tsunami aid for? Rebuilding the shrimp farms, which it financed in the first round. And it's leading to new conflicts. It's leading to a whole new concern. And I think part of the problem is the World Bank as an institution and the individuals in the World Bank really think they don't need to learn anymore. They don't need to look anymore. They don't need to draw lessons anymore. The second lesson I've learned in my last 30 years is not just that everyone is a student all the time, but everyone is a teacher in sustainability. No one can be excluded from the potential to teach. And when I say no one, I include the activist, I include the uneducated peasant. My first teachers of sustainability were the uneducated women of the Himalaya, the women of Chipko. They didn't know how to read and write. They'd never been to a school, leave alone a university. And yet everything I learned about the first principles of ecology was in my 4 or 5 years of volunteering with that movement. It could be the river as a teacher, the seed as a teacher, the earthworm as a teacher. It depends who inspires you as a teacher. But in sustainability, our education comes from every being, from every aspect of life. One of my favorite writings is a speech that Tagore actually gave, I think, in Chicago years ago. He was a Nobel laureate for literature who gave back his Nobel Peace Prize because of the war. And, you know, he was asked about what's the difference between India before globalization, of course, India before World Bank development, India and the West. And he said, the West has locked education in concrete and brick, whereas we have kept learning for the forest. And he was talking about literally till he started Shanti Niketan, the University of Peace outside Calcutta, very important university. And he didn't have classrooms. I spent four months there because my physics PhD guide was asked to come and start a physics department there, so I traveled with him. And there were no classes in BRIC, except, you know, there were beautiful trees under which you sat and learned, as learning has been for centuries. We've, of course, now caught up with the United States in locking learning into brick and concrete. Glass, actually. Lots of glass, which needs, at 50 degrees temperature, needs lots of air conditioning to survive. The third principle for me is that it is leaping beyond the Cartesian locks of division and separation. I think one of the most tragic moments of human evolution was when, at the beginning of the scientific revolution, a bunch of men just decided that knowledge was reliable only when it was made totally unreliable. And you could define as totally objective that which had nothing to do with reality. That abstract categories became primary qualities. And primary qualities were reduced to secondary qualities about which you could not be certain. You couldn't be certain about smelling rotten food? or chemicals, tasting chemicals in your food. You couldn't be certain about that drilling that goes on across my room at the Kellogg Center while they renovate the hotel. Can you imagine to be reduced to that level of uncertainty that our most basic indicators of relating to the world through our eyes, through our ears, through our nose, through our tongue, through our tactile sense, all that knowing was erased. And then we was put out with measuring, constructed, abstract constructions. And I believe that has been a very big reason why not only have we ended up destroying so much of the world, but it's also a reason why we've ended up creating so many illusions about, for example, producing more food when we are reducing food availability in the world. The work I've done on the Green Revolution, which I started really because I was so puzzled with the fact that Punjab, the land of the Green Revolution, was at war in the 1980s, particularly 1984. We'd had an attack on the Golden Temple, after which Indira Gandhi, the prime minister of that time, was assassinated, one of our most violent years. And Nobel Peace Prize was given to the Green Revolution. It's not hanging together. Why did Borlaug get a peace prize, and why is there war in Punjab? Which part of it is true? So I spent a year and a half doing a study for the United Nations and eventually wrote the book called The Violence of the Green Revolution, in which I connected three kinds of violence. The violence to the earth, because Punjab might have had lots of financial flows with the credits and the World Bank loans and the subsidies. And if you measure all that, it was booming. But if you look at nature's economy in Punjab, it was being devastated. 150 crops had been reduced to rice in one season and wheat in the other season. One monoculture across an entire state, then inviting all the pests, which were followed by the pesticides, which then killed all the pollinators, which required then more pesticides. Today, if you go to Punjab and look at a wheat field, you have to hunt for the wheat because the weeds have overtaken. The more they sprayed herbicides, the more the weeds have prospered. And all that didn't happen for free. The first bit of seed and the first chemical came for free. That's what the subsidies were used for. But then the debts started to pile up. And today the farmers are so indebted. And there's been an acceleration since globalization with the liberalization of markets and seed, liberalization of the chemical markets, and the globalization of trade, which has led to dumping, and the famous $400 billion that of subsidies that brought the Cancun negotiations of WTO to a halt, depressing prices, the combination of costs of production shooting up tenfold in a decade, and prices of crops dropping to one-third, has basically meant that annually, Indian peasants, according to our studies of empirical data of price collapse, are losing, just in crops, we're not talking plantations, we're not talking non-food production, we're just talking of the mainstream crops, the rice and the wheat and the cereals. Indian peasants annually are losing $26 billion annually. The entire aid budget of the world is $50 billion. So half of it is being evaporated in India alone, but that same thing is happening in Africa, and the same thing's happening in Central America. And if you recognize that a quarter of the farmers and peasants are in India, then it's about $1 trillion being lost just in terms of falling prices annually. And that doesn't take into account the rising costs of production. Why are the costs of production rising? Because on the one hand, the seed sector has been liberalized, and that was part of what the WTO and the World Bank required. And the kind of seed supply that Latin American countries have had, African countries have had, India has had, is normally 80 to 90% seed supplied by farmers themselves, from seed evolved over millennia. And that's where the real diversity is. India had 200,000 rice varieties. Navdanyar movement has saved more than 2,000 rice varieties now, after all the erosion of the Green Revolution. Hundreds of bean varieties, dals, legumes, wheats. We grow 35 kinds of wheats on our small little farm, one of which, by the way, was patented by Monsanto last year. And we challenged them, and the patent was revoked. It was a patent for an old Indian wheat variety. This is so funny, because the patent application said the wheat they're using is derived from an Indian wheat variety, except that because they'd stolen the wheat, they didn't know its name. But it was stolen from the border of India and Nepal. And I can just imagine someone on the phone saying, near Nepal, and the pirate was hearing, you know, Nepal became Nepal, and by the end of it, Nepal became the name of a variety. But in Hindi, Nepal means Napal, which is that which gives no seed, which no Indian peasant would name their variety. So we had a wonderful time challenging that patent, and in September last year, the patent was struck down. And more recently, on 8th of March this year, on International Women's Day, we won a very big victory against another biopiracy case, the case of neem. And in this case, we took on the two biggest giants. One, a chemical giant, the W.R. Grace Company, but the patent was jointly held by the United States Department of Agriculture. And it was a fun case, because they'd say, how can she bring this case to the European Patent Office? She's not European. And this was, you know, in the European Patent Office court. I said, neither are you. Then they said, well, there are three of them, you know, three organizations joined up, all of us represented by women. Linda Bullard of IFOAM, Magda Elwitt, who was president of the Greens, and then the Belgian health minister and me. And said, oh, but there are three of them, and they paid only one fees. We said, there are two of you, and you paid only one fees. So no matter which argument they tried to use against us, technically on the same argument, they were being caught on the wrong foot. And for us, the neem case was very significant. It was most significant, first of all, because the neem is such a beautiful tree. And way back when the Bhopal disaster happened, I started a campaign immediately, 2 days later, called No More Bhopals, Plant a Neem. I just collected neem samples. And that time, Delhi had not been paved over. You know, so we still had soil, and the trees would, you know, drop their seeds, and hundreds of small saplings would come up. Today they can't. There's concrete all over. So I just collected hundreds of these saplings and took them down to Bhopal and distributed them and said, we don't need toxics that kill us. You know, here's this beautiful tree that does the same job nonviolently. And a decade later, we find this W.R. Grace patent. So for us, this was a very, very important case. It was the first case of biopiracy, and it was the first case legally challenged. And we won it after 11 years. That's another lesson in sustainability. Never give up. Never give up. And you don't give up when you hold hands. In every issue in which we've been able to take on big power, it's when we have stopped locking ourselves up in boxes. Yeah. I didn't fight the neem case as an Indian. We fought the neem case as a global solidarity of citizens, defending the biodiversity of the world, defending traditional knowledge, wanting to recognize the tremendous contributions that have been made by local communities, especially women. And yet recognizing that neem or any other plant that heals, gives us pest control properties, or gives us wonderful seed, needs to be available for distribution in the world, just as Mexico gave the world corn. Can you imagine where we'd be if the Mexicans had behaved the way Monsanto behaves now? Royalty first. There'd have been no corn. There'd have been no amaranth. There'd have been no potatoes in our diets. There'd have been no squash. There'd have been no rice. None of the crops that feed us across the world would have been in agricultural systems because they've all moved through a generous giving. And there's a person who works a lot for Monsanto. He's Indian origin. He works in the University of Tuskegee. He runs something called an Ag Bio website. And he said to me once in a debate, "Oh, you know, we wouldn't have been farming if my grandfather hadn't been a biopirate." I said, "Did he patent the seeds?" "No." "But he exchanged them." I said, "Exchanging is not piracy. Generosity is not theft. So exchange becomes piracy when you take for free and then want to treat it as your monopoly, and worse, your invention, as if it came out of your head. You know, the Cartesian disease continues. Everything comes out of the head. Intellectual property, the very term intellectual property, is defined as property in products of the mind, as if seeds pop out of Monsanto's head. Can you imagine? Property in products of the mind to cover seeds, genes, cell lines, microorganisms, Dolly the sheep. Poor Dolly the sheep. Remember, she was created by Ian Wilmot. And when all he did was mess her up. You know, 272 of the fused cells led to mutants. They were just flushed down. They tried to sell them as ground meat, but citizens stopped that. But one became what I call a short-term sheep. She's now in a museum. She didn't live a few years on display, but enough time for him to be called the creator and her to be called the created. But he's now wanting to clone humans after having failed in dealing with sheep. I think the other step, or the lesson in sustainability for me, is to give up that arrogance. The arrogance that came with the series of projects of domination, whether it is colonialism or it's patriarchy or it's reductionism parading as a scientific revolution, or theft of raw material and takeover of territories parading as the Industrial Revolution. I don't know how many of you have read this new book by Jeffrey Sachs. Wow, you don't know about him. He actually runs something called an Earth Center and it's supposed to be the brain for the Earth now. Yeah, one more of those. Fully knowing, absolute. Well, I haven't read his book. I have to buy it on this trip. But I did read the Time magazine about 2 weeks ago, in which the cover story is his article, which is a summary of the book. And, you know, of course, all these big guys are always going around ending the very things they've created. So he's talking about how to end poverty. And it's brilliant because he talks about how, he says, first we were all poor. Then we had the Industrial Revolution, and some of us got rich and the rest got left behind. So tell that story to the Native Americans. They didn't get left behind, they were pushed out. Tell that story to the Africans who were put onto ships to be brought as slaves to work on the cotton farms. Those factories would have ground to a halt without that slave labor. Tell that to the indigo farmers in India who were forced to grow indigo and could not grow food and were starving when Gandhi came. And then we had this huge resistance. And people started to say, I would rather die than grow indigo. I will not grow indigo. And the Champaran Satyagraha, as it's called, was the refusal to grow indigo, just as the salt Satyagraha was the refusal to pay salt taxes. poverty came out of systems of dispossession. Poverty was a product of land being taken away, and today's poverty is a product of biodiversity being taken away, water being taken away. There is not a human being on the planet who is not intelligent enough, creative enough, productive enough to not generate their livelihoods given resources. Another line in Jeffrey Sachs' brilliance is, people are dying because they don't have a dollar a day. Now, people are dying because you took away their water. You know, that's where cholera deaths increased. South Africa, Johannesburg, water privatized. 300,000 disconnections. People turned to contaminated water. They got cholera. 300 people died. They might have been earning $5 a day, but you'll be quite dead if you're having to drink contaminated water. You could be earning $10 a day, but if Monsanto wants $20 a day for its seeds and chemicals, you'll still be poor and you'll still be indebted. And that's the part of the picture that is not being internalized, because this boxing out is a boxing out as externalities. The ecological costs, the social costs, the human costs of a privileged redistribution. It's a revolution from the top. And on the top, in this revolution from the top, is literally the ultimate privatization of life. It's like a greed so insatiable that it cannot stop. You know, Marx talked about surplus labor. No, what's being appropriated is life itself. We're not talking about inequalities now. We are talking about a world system in which two-thirds of humanity will not have the ecological space for survival. Neither land, nor water, nor biodiversity. Because all of that is being transformed into private property and commodity. And in a world in which there's already a water crisis because of a green revolution that required 10 times more water, because of industrial pollution that did not know how to create efficient systems to produce goods and services, just two products in India that today are very, very important in pollution, leather and sugar. You know, traditional technologies of leather production didn't need water. They managed with very little bits of water. They didn't need rivers to contaminate. Today, leather factories are the most polluting of the industry. And our traditional sugar making didn't need a drop of water. Today, the sugar factories are some of the worst sources of pollution. So your entire industrial pattern, which did not take water into account in defining efficiency, it defined efficiency in terms of how many fewer people are involved in production. Labor was treated as the only input, not the resources that were wasted, as a result of which you created two massive problems: the ecological crisis of wastage of resources and the social crisis of wastage of people, reflected in unemployment. Today, there is no economic system in the dominant thinking which says, here's a place for people. Here is a place for engaging people's creativity. Here's a place for engaging people's productive capacity. Every measure of efficiency and productivity is get rid of people fast. But a planet with surplus people and abused resources is not a planet generating sustenance. So the two economies, the dominant system, is not able to address are the economies that sustain us, the economy of nature and the economy of sustenance. The babies we look after during the periods where they cannot engage in economic transactions our friendships, looking after each other in periods of need, when you're ill. That economy, wonderful feminist Hilka Pietilä from Finland did a study on this and worked out that 70% of the economy, when measured in terms of human energy, is the economy of care. It is the economy of sustenance, and also it happens to be, because of division of labor, the women's economy. And what is called the economy is one little thin bit, except that it's come, you know, and I look at it as, you know, as a triangle with the base as nature, robust, resilient, supplying us water, soil, biodiversity, the atmosphere. And you've got the sustenance economy where people meet their needs. Then you've got the market economy. And growth was defined as the growth of the market economy, but how it was eating into the sustenance economy and nature's economy was never looked at. So what you now have is an upside-down pyramid sitting vulnerable to topple any time, and made even more vulnerable because the market economy has made yet another leap of fiction that instead of transactions in goods and services, you now have totally fictitious transactions in imagined money. And so much of the brain power of humanity is going in how to create that fiction of wealth. $3 trillion a day, 60 times more than what we can produce on this planet. And that hungry money then needs to invest. That hungry money needs to then own that river, own that forest, drill in Alaska, and find every last place to turn money into more money. Because protection of people's lives and protection of fragile ecosystems has happened because there were hands-off laws. Yeah, you won't drill in nature reserves. You won't put factories in farmlands. You won't squeeze out rural areas by urban sprawl. And when each of those is lifted as an interference in investment and as a tariff barrier, what you basically have is this money that is 60 times more than what you can produce, requiring to literally take over the entire planet. And once it's taken over the entire planet, since it's got used to that imagined multiplication, you know, you sit on a computer screen, I don't even know how those things work, but, you know, the derivatives and the this and the that, all I know, it's one fun game of fiction, one big casino. But once you've got used to that, you're not going to imagine that when you start drilling out too much water, it won't keep filling up with fictitious water. You're going to run out of water. So when the market starts to define sustainability, you start to get a total confusion. And you start to replace the sustainability of nature, her vital ecological processes, the life support system she offers, the sustainability in terms of society, the ability for us to look after ourselves, each other, our communities. That's a sustainability, the ecological and social sustainability, is replaced by sustaining the market. And sustaining the market basically means keep extracting more and more out of nature and keep extracting more and more out of society to keep the market going. And I want to just share two of these imaginings of pseudo-sustainability in the area of water. Some years ago, Monsanto tried, it failed, but they did try to get into water also, into water privatization. And this document that was sent to me from someone in Monsanto had this, it was from their sustainability division. And the sustainability division basically talked about how there's a crisis, how many people are drinking polluted water, how the scarcity is going to grow. And then it went on to say, and all of this makes for a sustainable market. That's one interpretation of sustainability. But the other that is related to the other dimension through which corporations like Monsanto generate their own sustainability is, for example, through a combination of imposing laws of patenting of seed, and they are on record saying that the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement of the WTO was crafted by them and industries like them, by the Walt Disneys and the Pfizers and the Monsantos. And they've said, we did something unprecedented. We wrote an agreement and turned it into international law. And we were the patient and the physician and the diagnostician all in one. The problem is when 80% of the farmers, especially of the countries of the South, agricultural economies, when they save their own seeds, Monsanto can at best grab 20% of the market. And that too with very false claim. For 3 years they've been selling cotton seeds of BT, which is Bacillus thuringiensis genes put into the cotton. They sell it under the trade name Bolgard. For 3 years in a row, it's been failing. The promise was 1,500 kilograms per acre. Farmers have been harvesting 200 kilograms an acre. Farmers were supposed to get 10,000 rupees additional incomes per acre. They've been losing more than 6,000 rupees per acre. Now, for 3 years, every year, about 20 independent agencies in India put out their reports, and government agencies also. This year, the government of Andhra Pradesh has sued the company and said, you will have to pay our farmers compensation because they've lost so much. And Monsanto has sued the government in return to say, you don't dare interfere in our market. And it's going to be a very, very important issue. But I've just received a fax, one more fax this morning. Monsanto's claiming, because we just had a very big meeting on the failure, saying, farmers are getting 15% more and earning 5,000 rupees per acre additional. And, of course, they hire the Arthur Andersons and the A.C. Nielsens to spin reports for them. But that's not all they do. They also then try and corrupt governments to make sure the farmers don't even have their own seed supply so that the farmers are in a total seed slavery. So the sustainability of the seed, sustainability of biodiversity is then replaced by sustainable dependence on a single giant corporation for seed supply. And we are fighting those kinds of seed laws in India. Similar laws have been introduced under the Iraqi Order 81. Europe, farmers are fighting. In this country, I think 30 years ago it was done, and farmers didn't notice that the compulsory registration of farmers' varieties ended up meaning an end to farm-saved seeds. After that, with patent law, saving seeds is defined as a crime. And now Monsanto's suing U.S. farmers up to $3 million for contamination that they cause, reversing the polluter pays principle into the polluter gets paid principle. Volunteer crops, you know, a particular seed from last year grew out this year. And they've got helicopters going over the farm saying, last year soybean grew this year, you are a thief. So your entire crop belongs to us. That's what they did with Percy Smites, the Canadian farmer, sued him for $200,000. So the sustainability of farmers' livelihoods, sustainability of seed reproduction has to be destroyed for the sustainability of the market. And Coca-Cola says this in absolutely no uncertain terms. All of us in the Coca-Cola family wake up each morning knowing that every single one of the world's 5.6 billion people will get thirsty that day. If we make it impossible for these 5.6 billion people to escape Coca-Cola, then we assure our future success for many years to come. Doing anything else is not an option. Now, what does Coca-Cola's sustainability of making 5.6 humans dependent on them for quenching every time they go thirsty, for quenching their thirst each time? It basically means that they set up more and more plants, but those plants, even though Coca-Cola, this bottle is Michigan State University. Wow. They might have stopped now, but in the early days, when you saw a bottle of Dasani, it would say manufactured by, and they weren't talking about the plastic. They were talking about the water inside. Because part of that illusion of creativity is that creativity happens, or production happens, after capital has touched a natural resource. And in the case of Coca-Cola, every plant they've set up in India is mining 1.5 to 2 million liters a day. In their own records, there's a footprint of 5 to 6 liters for every liter of bottled water. That much water has to get destroyed. And of course, theirs will be an underestimation. My assessment is tenfold more destruction. And the destruction is both because of mining at rates higher than your water can be recharged, and leaving behind pollution. Pollution both from the the reverse osmosis that they use for bottled water, and for their bottled water plants, which flushes out all those things they use in these drinks that aren't supposed to be in food. Phosphoric acid to give you a kick. This thing that you use for antifreeze, for cars, ethylene glycol, they put that in tropical countries so that the temperature is reduced and you get an extra kick. All of that is then flushed out into the wells. And when they did this in a well, in a region called Plachimada in Kerala, the women organized because they were having to walk 10 miles to find water. Every home in Kerala has a well in their backyard. Kerala is the highest rainfall zone in India. Kerala has never had water scarcity, and Palghat has never had any water scarcity. But after Coca-Cola, they had a water famine. So women organized and were successful in shutting the plant down, but it's been successful in trying to get it reopened by reversing a court order. I've just got that message this morning. If it had come to me before I left, maybe I wouldn't have been here. I'd have had to rush down to Plachimada. But every place where Coke exists is a Plachimada. And my lama, this old woman, tribal woman, absolute, ultimate dignity and strength. When we organized a Women and Water conference, and she came over to Dehradun, and she obviously doesn't give long speeches. She just spoke 5 or 6 sentences. And one of her sentences was, I want everyone in the world to know when they drink Coke, they're drinking people's blood. Because do not forget where this comes from. And I think that to me is really the final lesson about sustainability. To be able to be aware of what is the beginning and what is the end of our production and consumption system. Where do things begin and where do they end? For contaminants, where do they end? For natural resources, where do they begin? They don't come out of magic. Those plastic bottles are piling up daily. And as we are made to distrust our taps, as we are made to allow our public utilities to collapse, as we are made to imagine this is where our water security will lie, not in our aquifers, not in our rivers, not in our lakes, but in the plastic water bottle, we are making sure that most beings on the planet don't have water, that most human beings don't have access to water, and after a while, nobody has access to water. This is a recipe for wiping out the hydrological miracle which allows us to live on this planet. And one design for this wiping out is these massive rerouting of rivers, taking all the Canadian rivers to take them to California and taking all the Indian rivers and to the big cities where the rich are. In Delhi, we have a big privatization going on with $100 million loan from the World Bank. They're trying to bring the Ganga water from North India, from the Himalaya to Delhi, to then be sold only only to the rich colonies, because only they can afford to pay 15 times more. And of course, all this will be done by Suez, one of the world's big giants. We have a beautiful movement saying the Ganga is not for sale. And it's been successful in forcing governments to say, sorry, we can't supply you Ganga water, otherwise we're going to have a revolution of people. You know, we're going to have farmers destroying these pipelines. We're going to have spiritual people who treat the river as sacred and refuse to accept it commodification, throwing us out of political power. That is a lesson in sustainability. And that education for sustainability, in the final analysis, I believe does two things for us. The first is it shows us that every action is an education. That it's not that there's education in the classroom and action on the streets. Every engagement in transformation is simultaneously educative, both for those who engage as well as those who are affected. You know, what we have achieved through things like our NEEM campaign is amazing in terms of the literacy we have spread on intellectual property. We have managed to teach more people about WTO and intellectual property than all the university classes of the world. Just by laying bare what this means. And not just laying bare how an irresponsible, unconstrained system of organized greed is devastating the very basis of our life, but also simultaneously to enable us to celebrate the miracle that is life. And that is why, for me, the final lesson in the education for sustainability is about learning again how to inhabit the earth as home. Not as a strange place, not as if as we were citizens from Mars, and not as if those silly gadgets and prisons they've created in U.S. airports for Homeland Security is home. You know, I mean, I look at it, I sometimes sort of, when I come to this country, I can but smile, you know, it's the most ridiculous transportation system in the world now. The way people have to queue up, take off their shoes, and nearly go strip, and, you know, and then every time they check you, they tell you they're going to be abusive, and, you know, and they tell it to you three times over, and I tell them, I've heard it, I know what you're going to say, I know what you're going to do, just go ahead. And re-inhabiting the world as home means re-inhabiting the world and the planet as home for the security it gives us. That is where sustainability lies. It also means experiencing life as a very secure member of the Earth family. Nothing to me is more secure than being able to sit on our organic in our organic farm and watch the pollinators flourish or the ladybirds come back to the wheat plants. And in this amazing journey of experiencing sustainability. What it does is more than sustainability, because it actually teaches us again how to be Earth citizens, how to reclaim not just our responsibility to take care of the Earth and of each other, but with that responsibility to be able to exercise the rights that we have as citizens of the Earth to protect everything it offers us in terms of making it possible to live. Thank you.
Dr. Shiva has graciously agreed to answer a few questions. So if you have a question, we'd be glad to hear it. I only ask, there's a large crowd and probably quite a few people with questions, so we would be appreciated if you would resist the temptation to expound and just ask your question.
You're talking about the soya industry? Yeah, the question is, how is the soya industry involved in India? Well, you know, we've had our own indigenous soya in the hills, beautiful black soya. It's called the bhat. And I remember as a kid, we could roast it and eat it. It was one of our favorite snacks, very high protein. But the soya bean that has been spread in the last, literally in the post-war era, is now the U.S. hybrid. And this was evolved really for cattle feed. It was evolved for cattle feed during the war when, because of the war, the United States wasn't getting enough of its shipments. But in addition to cattle feed, they then learned, also because there was a shortage of lard at that time, they learned through solvent extraction how to extract oil and fat from obstinate sources. In the case of lard, it was carcasses thrown away. And in the case of oil, it became soya oil, which is not an oil, edible oil in any sense of the term. You know, edible oils are those when you put between your fingers and you do that, you get oil like coconut. You can put sesame oil in a little pestle and you get oil. You put groundnut. You know, those are called edible oils. Well, oil just oozes out, and you can do it at any level in the household, in the cottage industry, at any level. Soya industry means you need solvent extraction plants. And about 20 years ago, the World Bank started to finance soya bean in a particular belt of India, which is sort of the Narmada Basin, the Malwa Plateau. And all of it used to get exported as cattle feed to Europe. And then the solvent extraction plants used to have some edible oil, but it was a very unpopular oil. Nobody consumed it. People looked down on it. It was really considered third rate. It wasn't what you eat. But 1998, an entire edible oil industry was slammed shut, and the soya oil imports were opened up overnight. And of course, the Soya Association had been camping in India and hanging around and ensuring that this happened. So what's happened now is 70% of India's edible oil has moved to imported, subsidized, probably genetically engineered soya oil. Meantime, the Indian industry is, what little there was, is collapsing because the subsidized soya is so much cheaper than the local soya, because it's not that subsidized. But we have a huge movement against soya monoculture because it has finished off the soils. It's finished off the farmers. There are huge pest infestations. I get visits from Madhya Pradesh farmers wanting us to come and help them convert to organic farming and to diversified agriculture. And it's really sad. You know, in 20 years, you can actually lose knowledge of farming. So Punjab, people don't know how to farm without chemicals, and it's a very, very big job. And the same goes for the soya industry. But my figures are that, you know, the world's agriculture, if we don't through our choices in terms of what we eat, what we buy, if we don't make our decisions felt on the marketplace, the world's food supply system is being moved to a soya monoculture. And it's being reconstituted into everything. You know, we Indians love dals. And now they want to sell us analog dals, you know. So you don't have to have your chana and your tur and your masoor and your moong. It'll all be soya, shaped into certain different shapes and colored in different dye. And I definitely don't want to live in an impoverished world of a soya monoculture. It's realistic in the sense it's happening. It's for real. Is it realistic in being able to change the patterns of corporate behavior? Not by having one, you know, this big Coca-Cola fight we have.
Well, every time there's an issue on mining of groundwater, they set up one little tank for water harvesting. And they call it corporate social responsibility. $1.52 million mined, 200 liters harvested. Yeah? So as long as you have 200 liters of showcasing and 2 million liters of destruction, it won't solve the problem of non-sustainability. And that's why it's not enough for corporations to declare how sustainable they are. The real report card is for communities that are impacted to declare that they are sustainable. I don't think it's just a school of thought. I think there is a deep inconsistency between the rules of a so-called free market, which is not very free, and is free only to the extent that it allows the deregulation of corporate behavior and commercial activity. And part of that deregulation is environmental deregulation, removing all the regulations that put limits on exploitation, pollution, etc. Now, deregulation of resource exploitation cannot then conserve the resources that you're overexploiting without any limits or without any regulation. And I can give you many, many examples of how the laws of the market and the laws of ecological sustainability are running into deep contradiction with each other. And globalization as deregulation as commerce has done is break down the capacity of governments to be able to put any limits. That's exactly what has been sacrificed. So what's the only thing now surviving is citizen concern for conservation to rebuild back into regulatory structures at various levels, local, national, global. The question was about my reaction to the appointment of Paul Wolfowitz as the new president of the World Bank. I'm actually quite happy. I'm happy not because I see him as improving the World Bank, but I'm happy because he will make naked the economic warfare that the World Bank does unleash. You know, since 1985, I've been forced to engage with the destruction caused by World Bank. But without Wolfowitz, the World Bank could look like a good development agency that helps poverty. And now we won't, you know, we don't have to go through that pretense anymore. We can deal with both the Iraq war and economic warfare as one agenda. It in a way helps consolidate citizen agendas for peace and sustainability. I think we've just kind of reached the stage where things can start getting ordered through the website. And it's not just that film. We've actually got some very, very nice films. We have a film on the whole prawn farming called The Violence of the Blue Revolution. We've got, I think, two films made by Indian filmmakers on the seed movement, one called Seeds of Life and another called Seeds of Freedom. More recently, a German. And a German filmmaker has made a very nice film on corporate control of seed as well as life out of control. He's a very thoughtful filmmaker, and he's made some copies available to us. Our website, the Navdanya website, is navdanya.org, N-A-V-D-A-N-Y-A. And this is not a reshuffle of my name. Some people actually think that. No, it means nine seeds, and it's the name I gave to the movement for saving diversity. N-A-V-D-A-N-Y-A, Navdanya. And the usual www's and all of that. .org, And on that site, you will find the publications, you'll find the films, but you'll also find announcements of the short courses we do at the School of the Seed. We call it the School of the Seed because we do learn from the seed. And, you know, they're very nice courses. And some of the courses involve excursion, you know, exposure tours to communities which are actually doing this work of building sustainable economies and reclaiming their self-rule over their water, over their seeds, over their biodiversity. Well, I think everywhere in the world, we need to recognize that every step of pushing people into poverty and unemployment is used as another step to create economic colonialism. So after people are rendered hungry, then GM foods are brought. And then GM, when you talk about the hazards of GM foods, the whole issue of poverty is raised. That they can't afford quality, they can't afford organic, because organic has been made artificially costly by subsidizing the chemical and genetic option. The same goes for water. And I think every time communities are artificially impoverished, it doesn't mean they get further hydrologically impoverished and nutritionally impoverished. And that's why I keep talking about the three economies. That making the market economy grow at the cost of nature's economy and sustenance economy is no way of solving a poverty problem. It is a sure way of increasing the poverty problem. And I think that kind of work needs to be best done regionally, because otherwise they will take each vulnerable community, create a new commodification system through that, and then keep enlarging like a cancer from there. And so basically I'm saying you've got here, you have a huge university, not that far, I was told this afternoon by the group that had come, just 1.5 hours drive. And I think the problem of Highland Park, it's called, the problem of Highland Park should be in the an issue of all the concerned citizens of Michigan. Anyone engaged in economic justice and anyone engaged in ecological sustainability. And of course, we'll be more than happy to send you what videos and all. We do have a video on the fight in Plachimada. I think we have a good CD on the public hearings because it went all the way to the parliamentary committee. And I know there was a young couple trying to make a new film. But I'll make sure we send you whatever. Yeah. Well, you know, I've both been a scientist, and I've studied science and technology policy for a large part of my life. And what I've learned there is any step in technology development or scientific innovation takes place in the public domain. It is then privatized at the end to corporations. And I think one of the biggest illusions and myths of our times is that without total corporate ownership and power, we will have no new technologies. That's not true. The early work in gene splicing was all done in universities. It's a different matter. It was rushed to Wall Street and is now patented by the DuPonts and the Monsantos. Every drug development, 70 to 90% of the research that feeds into drug development is done in universities and public sector research systems. I'm now on a very big committee set up by the Royal Society, which was the founder of the Industrial and Scientific Revolution. And even then, they had created limitations on ownership over technology, monopoly rights and exclusive rights over technology. And there is now a growing world opinion based on empirical facts that exclusive rights actually strangulate scientific innovation and technology development. And therefore, you need much more of sharing of knowledge and much more of facilitation in technology transfer of the sustainable technologies. Then you come to the fact that what have been offered as sustainable technologies are sometimes not. Monsanto's Herbicide-resistant and BT toxin crops are offered repeatedly as sustainable options. Neither of them are. Herbicide-resistant crops have increased resistant herbicides in farms, and that's becoming a big problem in the United States. And BT toxin crops have increased the occurrence of pests, including the bollworm, which it was meant to control. The fact that these scientific issues do not reach the larger public information system is partly because the companies do control communication and media in a very big way. But I've at least the technology of in the technologies of agriculture, I think chemical agriculture was the first regressive step in sustainability, and the two crops of genetic engineering that we have is the second regression. Ecological agriculture is the only way this planet can be fed using the limited resources, conserving them while producing the food we need. And agriculture is not like making a Boeing plane. Well, I think the first step of healthcare is to not create ill health. The first thing we need to strike off our list is junk foods, and recognized today by the WHO as the cause for the biggest disease epidemic of our times. The second is not criminalizing knowledge systems that cure. You know, the witch hunts were the first criminalization. You know, who were the witches? They were the knowers of healing. In this country, every alternative system of medicine is hounded out. You know, in the United States, you cannot treat cancer through alternative therapies. In Europe, it's all recognized. In India, 70% of all healthcare is still indigenous systems like Ayurveda, Siddha, Yunani, and folk medicine. And we need to maximize that. That doesn't mean the one rare herb of in the Himalaya should be exported all over the world. No. There'll be plants, healing plants in this continent as there'll be healing plants in Europe. And I think we need to turn back to the healing plants again. And the third issue is where they are. Synthetic medicines, new molecules, new healing through chemistry. We need to remove the patent restrictions. You know, India just was forced, literally, through the corporate influence, as well as the US. I mean, you know, Condoleezza Rice visited us just a few days before our patent law was changed. And I want to just, you know, as an aside, remind you that 2002, we had the horrible genocide in Gujarat. And in the shadow of that genocide, and I've talked about it in my book that's, I think, out now, from Seven Stories called India Divided, a patent law, a second amendment of the patent law was made. And at that time, the United States didn't say a word about Narendra Modi, the chief minister. But now suddenly he's a human rights violator. Because at that time, the BJP was in power and they were being used to change India's patent laws. Today, it's the Congress in power and the BJP has been used and thrown away. But the Congress just brought a new patent ordinance and then voted through, which both brings patents on seeds, and we've got a non-cooperation movement going, but it also changed the patent laws on medicine. India is the cheapest source of medicine in the world. The same HIV/AIDS retrovirals that U.S. corporations sell for $20,000, we make for $200, and we have managed to supply all of Africa. Now, with the new patent laws, Africans won't have access to that affordable medicine. Four companies used to make a cancer drug in India, which used to cost 10,000 rupees per month of treatment. Novartis has just brought in a patent, and four companies have shut down, and now Novartis's treatment costs 125,000 rupees per month, which even the rich of India can't afford. So what we are really seeing is both the creation of more disease and then a prevention of the ability to treat disease. I believe the three areas where sustainability, justice, humanity will necessarily have to be reclaimed, because if we can't, we don't live, is water, food, and health. And these are the three areas where it doesn't matter where you are. You could be in North America, you could be in India. Recovery of the commons and recovery of the public domain are the new democratic issues of our times. Thank you.
This is their Media Mouse production.